Yo, Hirsch.
Charles.
So here we go again, buddy, and we find ourselves down deep into the muck of national hopelessness.
Is that a new memoir title?
The muck of national hopelessness. Not a bad title. It could be an article, at least a journal article.
Actually, that's a great title, yeah.
Okay, so that could be the title of the show, folks.
Yeah.
Hey, Terry, I just read this morning in the news source that you turned me on to that I like so much, Axios. And there was a trustworthy poll that was conducted by Axios and Ipsos. And 1 week after the disgusting attack on the Capitol, it showed that 79% of Americans say America is falling apart.
I saw that.
Very troubling. Politics, economics, and the pandemic. You talk about a perfect storm. That's what we have going right now.
You're not going to get me to disagree with that.
I'm sure I'll get you to disagree with something. You know, there's got to be something. You know? If not, I'll tease you up to that. Yeah. Hey, man, you know, what I want to talk about today is I've been having inclinations that there is a possibility for what I feel may become a rising need for some sort of spiritual hope and grace in the hearts of people in America. Now, we typically don't talk in depth about God on the show. We talk about God, but not in depth. I want today to be an exception. And I want to talk to you about how can people find hope in the God that you and I know, not the God that is ever so destructive in the eyes of some people.
Wow. So, just so you know, that subject is never one you start with at coffee hour after church.
Is God really there and can he do anything? Or
yeah, in other words, yeah. In other words, you don't start with, let's have coffee. Can we talk about the real stuff? In other words, you don't begin there. It was a hard week, Charlie. It was a hard week. As a pastor, I'll just start there because what I do is pastoral care. That's what I do for ministry.
And I'm a minister of grace.
That word is actually the premise of everything I talk about, grace and sanctuary. And I'll be honest with you, Charlie, here's what I thought, is for all the years I taught that, so why wasn't it enough then? What are we missing that didn't take root?
You mean as a population at large, what is missing, or what about, you're talking about your audience?
Well, I mean, I start there, but then I ask, is that enough? I mean, I'm literally at the mercy something right now.
And I
of feel, not knowing.
I feel precisely the same way, and yet I feel there is a need for those of us who have been granted grace. All people are granted grace, but those of us that have recognized the grace of God in our life, I think it is incumbent upon us to try to help people who are feeling deeply lost and feeling no place to turn, no help anywhere. We have to try to come up with something, Terry. If we don't,
well, I start with the fundamental reality of grace is that we do a disservice if we start by trying to define God before we accept the grace of God. Because I'll give you an illustration. One of my favorite stories is an old Garrison Keillor story. It was a couple that remember the Lutheran church there,
right?
In the town.
Lake Wobegon.
And so the couple had a kid, grew up in Lake Wobegon. Good church kid, of course. And then he went to Minneapolis to go to university, of course. And what happens in university is the kids quit on God. You know how that is.
Of course.
They give up what they were taught in church. And so they were worried because their son quit believing in God. So they went to the pastor there. What was his name? Spencer or
I'm
something.
I'm sorry,
anyway.
I can't
pastor, Luther Bad. And they said, we're worried about our son. What's that? Because he doesn't believe in God anymore. And the pastor said this to them. He said, that's okay. God still believes in your son. Grace has to start there for me.
Before
I make this an issue where I have to decide what goes where, I have to start with the fundamental reality that there is a God who above all else cares, and that the imago Dei, the image of that God, is inside of me. Do I abuse it? Yes. Do I not understand it? Yes. But I've got to start there.
You know, you're speaking my language now, Terry, very much, because, you know, I've mentioned on the show before, and you and I have talked, that I'm studying, and my spiritual practice is of the mystical traditions, and I'm reading Meister Eckhart right now, and he is known as the most unsystematic of systematic theologians. I can talk about fancy terms of apophatic and cataphatic, and one of those fancy terms is about taking God literally, defining God, and defining the situation, the person of God, the way to follow God, and that's what we find in most churches today, both Catholic and Protestant. The mystic tradition is experiential. It is not knowledge-based. It is surpassing, it is taking the knowledge, letting the knowledge rest inside you, and then transcending the knowledge to the mystery of God. And that is where we understand God, is through mystery and through an unknowingness. And so through that creates an even greater dependency on God. Did any of that make any sense?
Yeah, and I wholeheartedly, because as soon as I make it a cerebral issue, then my well-being is predicated on whether I can create the right theology. As soon as my well-being is predicated on that, it's not on grace anymore. It's predicated on, do I believe the right thing? And if I believe the right thing, then you believe the wrong thing. And the next thing I know, we're fighting about that. I believe the right God, you believe the wrong God. Because I've not started with grace.
And as I'm very strongly into, is that I'm very, very Trinitarian these days. And the Trinity, the essence, the ontological essence of Trinity, of God, the being of God, is love. It is love and goodness. It is not wrath. It is not vengeance. It is not I'm going to get you. That is the whole beauty of the new covenant, and the whole beauty of the incarnation of the Christ, of Jesus, Son of God, coming to earth to change that whole wrathful situation and to reconcile us and redeem us and to bring us back into the presence of God in a beautiful and a wonderful, not in a moralistic or legalistic way, but in an experiential way that God is present within us and works within us, and all of our moralism, not to get the grace of God, but our moralism is a fruit of having that experience with God, that God comes in and intervenes and leads us.
Yeah, 100%. And the whole thing about grace is grace and humility go hand in hand. In other words, I don't need to be right to be loved by God. I don't need to be in first place to be loved by God. I don't need to have the correct religion to be loved by God. And the remarkable thing about being loved by God, even if you're, quote, Trinitarian, as you talk about, I don't even have to understand the Trinity.
No.
To know that I'm loved by God. See, that's the marvelous thing about it. But I grew up in a world where as soon as you don't believe, you're secure in that. If I'm not secure in that loved by God part, if I'm insecure in that, then I need something other than God for my security. Well, the next thing you know, I'm beating the crap out of people who are different than me.
it becomes, as Richard Rohr talks a lot about, it becomes a very dualistic, us versus them, right, yeah, wrong, and rather than a transcendent truth that rises above and transformed right or wrong or moral or immoral, and we go to the infinite presence of God. That God is, I like the way that I've read that God is not a being, God is being. Now, I'm getting very philosophical right now. If you try to make God a being, and if you try to make it the way you were raised, that you can define God, and you believe in certain characteristics and certain characteristics of is called the nature of God. As soon as you do that, you move into this, you move into a dualistic us and thems right away. And that belief, the words you believe are actually more important than the love that inhabits us.
Well, and then it's not just the love that inhabits us, but that you're talking about what spills from that. In other words, what spills from that love is, I mean, you know, justice, mercy, humility. I mean, that spills from that. In other words, if and I don't know if certainty is the right word, but if I have to have closure, there's no space for mercy and humility. There's no space.
Yeah, I am not a problem. I don't have a problem with certainty. I think uncertainty is good because that's what I like to call God room. Uncertainty is a room for God to invade us and let God determine the truths in us. Once I am certain, then it's not God. It's not, you know.
That's one of my favorite. You know, Karl Barth was my theologian that I read when I was young. But and one of my favorite books he wrote was I Think I Might Have Been Wrong.
I think I might have been wrong. That's the title of his commentary on Romans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually didn't know that was the title. I read the book, but I didn't know that was the title.
Well, yeah, but he has another book. He has a commentary, and then he has another book that he wrote getting to that.
I read the commentary. Yeah. I didn't read that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That he had, you know, he talked about, I had to admit I was wrong. That's the irony about saying that you're wrong, that somehow the reality has shifted if you say you're wrong about something. That's the craziness of all this.
You know, once again, betrays our friendship that we believe the same essentials, and that I have written in my blogs several times about the value of being wrong. And I like to say, never believe what I say today because I could change my mind tomorrow, because I could be wrong.
Right.
And, you know, you and Paul like stories, so let me tell you a story. When I first left the conservative church as a minister, when I say the conservative, well, it really wasn't that conservative, but it was an evangelical church. And I moved to mainline. I moved to the Anglo-Catholic Church of the Anglican Episcopal Church. The visiting preacher was the Bishop of Los Angeles and Orange County. Fred Borsch was his name. And he said something about, he was praying with, you know, an ecumenical prayer group with people of other religions. That's heresy in the conservative church, is that a Christian would be not only conversing with people of other religions, but actually praying with them. Hit a chord with me at that time because I was very new to the tradition. So I met with, the same day after, during coffee hour, I met with Bishop Borsch and asked him, I said, tell me, Bishop, you know, I don't understand the theology that you're using here. It doesn't make sense, you know, that Christians, you know, we need to be so distinct from everyone else. And Bishop Borsch replied to me, you know, Charlie, I get what you're saying. But the one thing I believe is that while I do believe the scripture is inerrant and the truth of the scripture is infallible. He said the problem is that while the scripture is not, me as a human being, I am prone to be wrong. He says, I must admit, I take my faith with humility and modesty, always knowing that I could be wrong. Now, if we all had faith like that, faith that's saying, I believe, it's like, I believe it was Jairus. I'm not sure. Jairus in the Bible said, I believe, but help my unbelief. Everybody, it's great to believe. It's wonderful to believe. But always believe with a sense that God could correct my thoughts.
Well, and because that goes back to the thing that the anchor for my identity and my value and my worth is not predicated on how right or wrong I am. It's predicated on the grace of God, period.
That was good. That was
because I, Charlie, I had to do in seminary, I had to do a class on proving the existence of God. And I was graded on that, Charlie. Graded.
By
arguing for something.
I so agree with that. And I think that those notions propel some people in our political spectrum to deep beliefs that they are right and that God is on their side and only on their side and not at the side of others, which really gets us into a lot of trouble. I think we saw the fruits of some of that trouble a week ago Wednesday.
Right. Well, that's an interesting thing about God being on my side, because that's fascinating. God giving God's grace, creating value for me, is just simply a yes or no phenomenon, and I say yes. And that would be yes for everyone. But as soon as I need to then therefore say that we have to take sides with it, then I don't believe the first premise.
Well, that's a whole problem theologically with understanding God. If we're taking sides, we A, have to assume that we understand what side we're taking. And that assumes, then the second assumption, is that we understand God. And then I go to three, that's stupid. Because once I understand God, I think I understand God, I have limited God. I have no wellspring of hope and growth and civil practice, spiritual practice, the kind of practice that Jesus did when he roamed the lands of Israel.
Right. I don't disagree with that.
So let's talk. We've given everybody sort of our theology, but I'd like to move to praxis. I'd like to try to attempt to give help in understanding how might a theology of grace impact a nation that is lost in feeling that America is falling apart. And I think that's such a deep question, we should probably take a break and then come back to that question. But that question is, how might we inherit and apply this grace? Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and we're listening, and we're doing a very difficult podcast today. Terry Hershey and I are doing a very difficult podcast because we're trying to be candid and open and raw, which is going to create controversy and is going to create disagreement, and I try not to have a controversial show, but I think the times are calling for us speaking from the heart. And Terry and I are talking about the despair in America, and is there resolution, any resolution in the grace of God in this? Now, before we get to that question, during the break, my producer asked me a question, Terry, and this is for you. What is grace?
Grace is the realization that my identity is not predicated on anything that I need to earn or leverage.
You don't have to go any further. That's beautiful.
That my well-being or value has nothing to do with what I earn or leverage.
So what is your well-being or value based on? I agree with you. So let's continue with that. What is it based on?
The theological term I say is the image of God, that inside of you is that image. And that's my well-being. That I, as a child of God, that's good. Well, there's nothing to prove. Irony is that if I have something to prove, then my identity is predicated on that proving. And that's an interesting kind of way to do it. In other words, okay, so I want to be a giving person or a compassionate person or whatever. Well, if my identity is predicated on proving it, then I'm doing all those things, in other words, to be somebody. Well, no. If, in fact, I'm already secure in who I am, in that grace part, then all of the endeavors that I have, good endeavors, spill from that. They're not meant to make me someone I'm not. They're not meant to impress.
You know what you're sounding like, Terry? You're sounding like a mystical theologian.
I'm glad you said, Charlie. I'm glad you didn't say, you're sounding like a preacher. I'm glad you didn't say that.
No, God, if I said that, that would have been, I'm sorry. Sorry, my fellow beloved ministers, but that would be an insult to Terry Hershey. I've read a handful of the people that take this way of not dogmatic theology, but experiential theology that is based on Imago Dei, on the image of God, on the incarnation, on Jesus coming, on the Son of God becoming human and imparting a love and a whole value system that is not based on performance or based on being able to prove God. And, you know, I could say for our people, great theologians to read are St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, Thomas Merton, Meister Eckhart, Bonaventure. Those at St. Bonaventure, those have been my reading resources for the last year. And do you know when all that changed, Terry? Do you know when, you know, we've always had this very, you know, sort of moral legalistic tradition, but that mystical tradition existed and then disappeared for a while. And you know what brought about its disappearance? Was the age of rationalism, the age of reason.
Reason, Ed, yes, correct.
Science was taking over religion, and people were believing in science more than they were believing in religion. So the religious, instead of depending on this wonderful relationship with God, wanted to prove it scientifically, wanted to prove God scientifically. And so that's where we came with systematic theology, which, you know, all through seminary, when my 3 years in seminary, I fought systematic theology like crazy, because it was all about defining God and proving God. And that began with the age of reason. And we are now entering a newer age, and I don't mean new age, we are in an age of no reason, but it is an age of experience. I keep saying that word, and I'm realizing that's a very strong word for me, is it's experiential in my heart that I am I am union. I'm in union with the divine, and the divine is guiding me deep within my soul, and I don't have to worry about proofs. And that,
yeah, and see, you know what's good? The good news, of course, is that now when you read Einstein, you realize that what you just said and science are actually in the same page.
True.
Because science is the truth of science is really about mystery and awe. And the science you were referring to back in Ancient Reason is we somehow as a species, human species, we wanted to somehow find confinement and closure on everything, which included God. And systematic theology is one of the strangest, weirdest things we did for trying to learn about God. I mean, really weird.
And systematic theology really began like in the 19th century, didn't it? I mean, was there such a thing as systematic theology before the 19th century?
I think it started with some people who were really messed up emotionally, and they decided, let's just spill this down to seminarians for decades to come. I think that's what happened. They were having beers, and they thought, you know what? We didn't have a good life. Let's make it messed up for everybody. One of the conundrums is, as long as I belong to this thing where I have to be, quote, on, that's the irony of this. I mean, this is what we're seeing now with what's going on. You have to be on someone's side. I'm thinking, wait a minute. What does mercy have to do with a side?
Yes.
I don't get that part. What does justice have to do with a side? I don't get that part.
That's why I'm so.
And you and I mean, you and I have disagreed on many, many things, quote, theologically and even, quote, socially. And we have conversations, and we'll have conversations. But I don't ever remember us having any even sort of fights verbally about it per se. But I don't remember either one of us having to say one side. We didn't go there.
Yeah, just that seems, it's like side seems like such a anti-God notion that it is against essence of God.
I was actually working through this because I was thinking about I wrote a thing about Rosa Parks, not Rosa Parks, but a lady in Martin Luther King's church. And now her name escapes me, but she wanted to march, and Martin Luther King said, "No, you can't march with us. You know, you're old." And she said, "Yeah, my feet is tired, but my soul is rested." And then I wrote that she, because she wasn't a victim, and this was the sentence, because she was a victim, she was able to engage and care about life. Now, I love that sentence is great because if my identity is not at rest, this is when I went back to grace, then I feel like I'm a victim of something or someone. See, there we're on sides again. We have victims. No, there are true victims of violence and sexual assault. But that aside, I am not a victim of the discomfort of life. And as soon as my identity is that way, and that's why I have the capacity now to enter into the fray, and this is like me and you again. Enter into the fray because the disagreement is not the end all and be all. Grace is the end all and be all, and we can be at the same table.
Well, actually, I would go so far as to say that the disagreement is healthy, and that it approaches to that ideal we were talking about, taking sides and being right and wrong. And assuming the role of always thinking, always knowing that I could be wrong. And so our disagreements give me insight. I could be wrong. You know what? Terry could be right on this, or right, or Terry could be have a good point on this that I need to pray about, think about, research.
Charlie, I couldn't hear that sentence again. Would you say that sentence again? Terry could be, what was it? right about this.
I did, didn't I? See? Look at this. You know, it's just, you know, gosh, you know, it is just, we are so ingrained in it, are we not?
I know. It's so bizarre. It's like.
Here we're talking against it, and I'm using it as a definition.
I know, but my point is, I didn't know there had to be a person right or wrong about it. I didn't get that part. But, however, having said that, taking a look at some of the things that happened in the last week, you have to speak out about something, right?
Right? Yes. Yes, I'm very careful about, as you know, about politics. And I think the things that have occurred in the last week, it is a sin to ignore the politics. It's ignoring the very life existence of people. Structure of our democracy is at risk. These are very, very troubling times, and it does have to be. You nailed it, Terry. It is all a bit about being right or wrong. Or less, more than that, sides, my side or your side.
I mean, when I did some things earlier in this 20, well, from the last few years, it's one of the first times I've been invited to do conversations with groups about how do you talk to people in your family who are completely different. In other words, this is the first time in my 40 years of doing ministry that I've actually been invited to talk about that, which is curious to me. Because there's always been different parties. And so that's an irony to me. However, politics is not a dirty word. Politics is simply about how we engage as human beings together. That's politics.
Yes.
Now, political choices, decisions, strategies, that's a different kind of thing. That's how you manage that. But politics itself is a neutral word. That's how you get along. Well, that means you have to start with the fact that there's a we in that sentence, not an I. If there's a we, then the question is, what does it mean for us to be a community? What does that look like? And can we be honest about things that break that community? What's the fracking that goes on that messes with that community? And I have to answer that question without being a sort of taking sides thing. Does that make sense?
Yes,
I have to say there's things that frack the community, that break the community, without saying it's me versus you.
You're going to have to help me with one word. I don't know what frack means. I know it's a...
Fracking is the what we did to get oil out of the earth by breaking different layers of the earth.
I see. Okay, so it's breaking layers.
Breaking, cracking.
I have to in this conversation, and we're talking about taking sides. You know what is a big driver in that? What's driving the vehement oppositions? It is a culprit on both sides or all sides. It's not two sides or many sides now, but it's fear, Terry. And what are we afraid of? What are we afraid of? Is it afraid of power? What is the fear that's going on there? Because I think the fear is what's driving, and I think it's the fear of everyone. It's not one particular political affiliation.
You lost me on that one, the fear part.
Oh, did I? You don't think it's about fear? You don't think it's afraid of losing something? Of losing influence, control, our power, our position, our prestige. You don't think those are drivers in there?
You mean that's why people react the way they do?
Yes, yes.
I don't know.
Oh, that's
I literally don't know, Charlie.
Okay.
No, I don't see it. I don't see that.
Yeah, I'm pretty strong on one.
I mean, the fear part, I get the fear part in the sense that if my identity is not in a good place, then yes, I'll be driven by fear. There's no doubt about that.
Three things that are very important to me that it will define my party, and that's freedom, especially freedom of speech, meritocracy, and I said I have three. What's the third one? Meritocracy, freedom, and individualism. And I am afraid of losing those. I am deeply afraid of losing those. But I'm not going to,
Are you going to beat? Are you going to beat somebody up over it?
That was exactly what I was going to say. I'm not going to be violent over it. I'm not going to have vitriol over it. I think the only thing is, the only solution is dialogue, and it's trying to understand.
See that now we're back. See now we're back to the we in that sense of the we, the community. If I start with that fundamental reality, if grace exists and our identity is intact because of grace, we start with a we. That means we come to the table, and if we start with we, the politics is we. The politics is we. Now, the political ramifications, those are the nuancing, quote, laws, et cetera, we passed. Now, let's fight it out about what individualism looks like. Well, that's a whole different deal than putting the cart before the horse and saying, my idea is the right idea, you're wrong. Because there's something that's inadequate in my identity. And so I wasn't seeing it as fear so much as the fact that I don't have a grounding to stand on. Therefore, I have to hate you before we even get to deciding what that looks like.
Oh, now you're getting to the heart of it when you're starting about now I have to hate you in order to justify or verify my beliefs.
See, the point is, Charlie, if I don't start with grace begins with assumption, if grace is real for you, that means we start with we. If we don't start with we, then the only thing that links us is hostility.
Gosh, that's very strong. You know what I'd like to close with? You know, I'd like to close with, pretend I have a flip chart. And we're brainstorming, and so we're not coming up with a pre-designed list of things people should follow, but brainstorming, how can we in America, as individuals, but how can we as an individual, how can we incorporate that kind of grace, compassion, understanding with the knowledge of that is who our God is. That is how we are created. We are created to be that way. What are things we might apply in our personal life or seek in our personal life in order to imitate those beliefs?
How can I affirm and realize grace is alive and well with me today? And therefore, how can I then therefore not be a victim and sort of step into life, into the, quote, fray, knowing that grace is alive and well there, but not everyone sees it. And so it's a cacophony. How can I do that? And so how can I carry that message of grace and well-being and community and therefore mercy and justice? How can I carry that? And how can we do that even in, because we can now do that in places where we can disagree without killing each other.
You just restated my question in a much better way than I asked it. How? Let's just think of I'll start it, and I'm just going to quote you. We begin with we the people, not I the Charlie. It begins with a we.
Right. Right.
What else would you add?
I mean, it's an interesting thing that it almost has to happen, you know, where I can, in individual relationships, find with people who are, because the sides are so, how can I hear or listen? Tell me. I want to know what's going on there. How can I listen? How can I hear? This is a story that has nothing to do with the current situation per se. But here's what's interesting, Charlie. Back in the day.
Back in the day.
I told this to back when I was a pastor and cared about church.
We said we were going to be honest.
I used to do conferences, as you know, big conferences about single people in church, and these pastors, lots of pastors came to these big conferences, and they asked, well, what do you do with homosexuals? They didn't call them gay. Homosexuals, this is back in the day.
Yeah.
And, of course, my answer was, you know, we hate the sin and love the sinner, which...
That was the comment.
Honestly,
that was
a dumbass thing to say.
And that was the point.
You say it because you just... Here's the thing is, because I didn't believe in grace, and therefore I had to say the right thing to prove that I was somebody. See, I didn't believe in grace. So I had to say something to prove that my side was right. So I said that. And so I had a couple of pastors who happened to be... They happened to be gay, but they were at the conference. They came to my office, and they said, because they've known me, and they'd known about me a little bit, and they said, Terry, I know you said that. Please don't say that again. And I said, why? They said, because you don't believe it. That's not who you are. In other words, I was saying stuff that wasn't me, Charlie. And I know I'm trying to say that about today's stuff, too. I don't need to say stuff to impress somebody. I need to say stuff to make us a better we. What do I say to make us a better we?
I love that. You know, Terry, I've been to several of your conferences, and you and I had talked, but I watched the way you engage with your audiences, and you have always talked a message of hope, a message of grace, a message of the goodness of God expressed through the goodness of individuals that God and this message of non-judgmentalism, openness, acceptance of the God of grace. You have such a powerful following. Why is it that people want to, so many people want to come and listen to you? What is it that you offer? I think that's the question we close with. But what is it you offer in this that makes God attractive to people?
The honest answer I give when I'm hired, people say, and it's not always religious events. You know, I'm hired for healthcare, education, et cetera. But people say, what will they get from their time with you? In other words, what's the takeaway?
Yeah.
What will they walk home with? They want to know, what are we paying for?
Right.
And my honest answer is simply this. If it's 90 minutes, 2 hours, whatever, I'm with you. At the end of that time, they'll be glad to be alive.
It almost brings tears to my eyes, Terry. That at the end of the time with you, they will be glad to be alive. And what my hope is that a handful of people that think like you and I, and it's more than a handful, you know, there's a number of people that think that we could offer that message to people that are saying that America's falling apart, that we could help them see, I'm glad to be alive. This is a catastrophic, horrible situation that we are in, but that we are glad to be alive, and we are glad for me that we could somehow help people to understand that that is the goal of God, that we are glad to be alive in the presence of divinity.
Yeah, and amen. And because of that, when that is true, then now we care. Now we really care.
I could ramble on in this conversation forever, but I'm not going to. I'm going to close it up. Thank our audience for participating in this emotional and a bit unguarded conversation that we didn't know where it was going to end, which is not unlike us. But I want to thank you for sharing, for enlightening us with your wisdom, your compassion. And what I like to look at is your offering alternatives for a life of peace, a life of hope, and involved in a life of grace. Thank you, Terry. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning into the next chapter with Charlie. You can check us out on our website, but I'd rather you just ponder the thoughts and think, how can you be a part of grace and love and compassion and care for your sake, if not for the sake of our country? This is Charlie Hedges, like I said, signing off. Bye for now.